Good afternoon, good evening. You're tuned into Real People of Orange County on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are available via podcast, both on KUCI's website and at KimberlyMartin.com. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Kimberly is out, but I'm pleased to be able to sit in both this week and next. As you know, this show is an informative look inside the lives of Orange County's best and brightest. The guests on this show are all people who serve their community in a meaningful capacity. And it is graduation time here at UCI. It's graduation time all around the country. And so it is my pleasure to welcome some Orange County, original Orange County graduates who have left the Orange County nest, the warmth of Southern California, and explored horizons all over the nation, in one case, all over the world. And we are going to bring three of them on to talk about what it's like to be a graduate in this new millennium, some of the things that they've been up to, how Orange County has helped launch them off into their careers, what it's like to come back home periodically. One of them joins us by phone. He's up in San Francisco. We're going to talk to him first. Troy Astorino is the co-founder and CTO of Picnic Health. His past work has ranged from building a Monte Carlo simulation service for SpaceX to writing satellite command and control software for Lockheed Martin. Growing up with two doctors for parents, improving healthcare technology has been a long-term interest. Troy has a BS in aerospace engineering and physics from MIT with a focus on machine learning and a minor in economics. We will welcome him on. Troy, how are you?
Doing great, Marie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. This is fun. I appreciate you doing this. So I'm going to give you a chance to sort of, I gave you a little introduction, but I'm going to give you a chance first to talk about Picnic Health, you know, what the company does, how you got involved in it, and kind of take us into your world.
Sure. Sounds good. So Picnic Health, what we do is we help patients who see lots of doctors in different health systems deal with their medical records. So people seeing a lot of different doctors, there can be a lot of overhead around needing to keep track of what's going on with your health because all of your doctors aren't necessarily talking to each other. So the onus falls on you as a patient to pull everything together and keep all of your doctors on the same page. And this can end up being a big burden, so we kind of just step in and take care of that for people. We collect all of their records on their behalf and then organize and structure the information to put it into a online timeline that's, like, very friendly, easy to use, and makes it, like, easy to understand what's going on in your health history.
Do you get involved in the insurance part of it as well, or are you just assembling medical records?
We don't get involved on the insurance side. We work directly for patients.
Okay. The world of healthcare is changing so dramatically. I'm sure your parents have experienced this since they've been a part of it. And so I'm wondering, you know, sort of your growing up, when you knew this was an area you wanted to go into and sort of your path into it, because I think so many of these careers are so cool, but the path to them is so elusive. So talk a little bit about how you got interested in it and then how you started pursuing the path to get there.
Yeah, for sure. So as you mentioned in the bio, my parents are both doctors. They're ophthalmologists in Orange County. My mom practices in Laguna Hills, my dad in Newport Beach. And so I kind of always had exposure to what was going on in healthcare, and in fact, like, you know, worked sometimes doing like a little bit of like IT consulting for them, and worked in my dad's office directly. And it's kind of funny because initially when I like worked with them, I kind of thought, man, healthcare, like data in healthcare is so messed up. There's like no way that I can actually like, you know, that things are going to get better. It's like, isn't a field at all that I'd want to get into. So like initially it was kind of like overwhelmed with like seeing like walls of like paper files and like folders full of information. But then, yeah, in school, started getting more into, computer science and web technologies and kind of how they have this, like, very kind of powerful, like, transformative effect where you can take, you know, situations where you have, like, a lot of problems, a lot of complexity, and kind of abstract that and give, like, solutions that make things a lot easier and then distribute them to a lot of people. So after I graduated, I graduated in 2013. There's like around, I guess since 2010, there's been a lot of activity in the health space with the migration to electronic medical record systems, more recently with the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, kind of thought, well, with all of this activity and change, it's kind of a good time to maybe step in and see and, like, you know, make sure that things change in a good way.
Right. How helpful were your professors, you know, as you were formulating these ideas? It seems really difficult to go from here's a great idea to actually executing it. And I was wondering if your time at MIT, if, you know, if your professors were sort of tipping their hand to help you out, or, you know, what the path along the way looked like in college to get you ready for this.
Yeah, so at MIT, there are a lot of different it's really more like student groups around entrepreneurship. A place like Stanford has like a lot of, like a very deep connection, say, to like startups in Silicon Valley. But really, like at college campuses, like all over the place, I think, you know, people are seeing that recent graduates and like even people in college can like start having like very, very big effects as entrepreneurs, and so there's a lot more resources available for people to kind of start going down that path. For me at school specifically, I guess my freshman year there was a web programming competition, which was kind of my first dive into web development, and then after that there were various like sort of incubation programs that would kind of like walk you through like what is it like to, like, what are you thinking about when you're trying to start a company? How do you, like, pitch that? You know, how do you meet with investors? How do you hire? How do you, like, come up with a vision? But really those were all, I guess, student groups that I was involved with.
Did the aerospace and engineering and physics, has any of that come in to help you out?
Has any of that? Not directly. It certainly is, I think, like, very valuable. It kind of, like, makes you think at a very, like, I really enjoyed them, and also, like, makes you kind of think at a very, like, abstract, like, rigorous level. And so, like, you know, dealing with, you know, medical records and, like, making web interfaces for them, I'm not specifically doing anything, like, physics or aerospace related, but the same sort of thought processes really helped me work in this space and, like, think effectively.
Yeah. Are there, so tell me a little bit about the office space. Is this something you can do? Do you go into an office? Can you do a lot of this work from home? How many people are in the company? Sort of tell me a little bit more about kind of how the company is structured.
Sure. So I met my co-founder, and that's actually kind of how we got working on the specific problem we have now. In, I guess, January of 2014, and we were both, I was actually working out of my parents' house in Laguna Hills, and she was up here in San Francisco, and, like, we would travel back and forth, but, you know, most of the initial work, yeah, I was just, like, you know, coding a lot, talking to people occasionally with phone meetings. But then in the summer of 2014, we were accepted into a startup accelerator called Y Combinator. It's actually, like, a really cool program, like Dropbox, Airbnb, Stripe, companies like that have gone through it. And so after that, we moved up to San Francisco, or I moved up to San Francisco. And then after going through the program, we kind of got an office space in the city. So we're in the heart of San Francisco right now. We have about 8 or 9 people coming into the office day to day. So things are pretty exciting.
That's very cool. And how do you advertise all through the web? Like, how do patients find you, or is it doctor referral, or tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, we have a mix of ways that people find us. Like, right now it's been a lot of referrals, just, like, you know, initially it was, like, you know, personal friends, and then, like, them reaching out to other people. We do, like, kind of directed outreach through different disease communities. So, like, there are some for example, like some common diseases like cystic fibrosis, where like, you know, mothers of kids who have like this like pretty horrible disease have like this big problem where they're like trying to like figure out any way they can to get their like kids better. And so they have a particular problem around seeing like lots of different specialists. So, you know, we've been in touch with some people in the cystic fibrosis community, and they've like thought that we've been like a great tool for helping manage this complexity. And so they kind of spread through there. So like right now it's kind of a lot of organic growth through referrals.
It seems so brilliant because you've got all of the baby boomers who are getting into, you know, geriatric age, and, you know, the healthcare system is so messed up. You're going to be very, very busy.
we're pretty busy as it is. We really think that, like, the opportunity for doing what we're doing has only come about because of really the shift to electronic medical record systems. Although that shift in and of itself has not, like, solved the problem that it's supposed to solve, which to some extent is interoperability and making sure that doctors can transfer information between offices seamlessly. Unfortunately, with the way that, like, EMRs have been implemented and the regulations around them, they're still very siloed. And so just because even if two offices have electronic medical record systems, sorry, that's EMR, from the same vendor, you can't seamlessly transfer information. So that's where, like, we come in and we collect it for patients and make sure that all the doctors have up-to-date information.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds really complicated with all of the confidentiality rules that govern medical records. I would think that, you know, it would be a legal nightmare to get access to all of this stuff and integrate it.
Yeah. I mean, basically for every request, we get explicit authorization from our users to go collect that data for them.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, a lot of the ways we get records for a patient is using fax,
which is
a little surprising, but it's like kind of the standard way that information is still transferred between offices. Right. And luckily, at least now, though, when our faxes come in, they're like typed out instead of handwritten, because we were having to process and, you know, run OCR on handwritten notes. What we're doing right now would be pretty much impossible.
That's hilarious. In doctor's handwriting, which is notoriously fantastic.
Exactly.
Faxing doctor's handwriting. I love it. That is funny. You're tuned into Real People of Orange County on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are talking to college grads, all originating from Orange County, who have gone off to do exciting, cool things. And, you know, it strikes me, I have a teenage daughter, and just knowing the world as it is now, everything is changing so quickly. I feel like we're on the cusp of this hockey stick that's going in directions we don't know where it's going. And so it's so hard to advise people of your generation and the people coming up under you of what the heck they should do. You know, you tell everybody to go to college, but you don't quite know what you're telling them to go to college for. So I thought it would be great to bring three people in from three totally different areas. The thing that all unites you, and I haven't introduced Eric and Emma yet, but the thing that all unites you is you're all SAGE graduates right here from Orange County. So I'll let Eric and Emma pipe in. I think they know you, Troy. So if you know Eric Hallett and Emma Ramadan, they are all here. So you can pipe in as you wish.
Hey guys.
Hey Troy. It's Eric.
How's it going?
Class of 2011.
Hi Troy.
Hey Emma.
Yeah, I love that. I don't know. I just love talking to younger people, finding out the exciting paths that they're taking. Because, you know, back in my day, I hate to sound old. I'm in my mid-40s. Back in my day, you know, we went to law school or medical school or accountant school, or I don't even know. But the paths were much more traditional, and all three of you have forged such unique paths. It's cool to talk to you. Is there any – I'll let you wrap up, Troy, but is there are you experiencing a lot of competition for what you're doing? Are there other companies out there that are competing for your business?
There are a lot of companies kind of that are hoping to, like, help people unify all of their medical information, because it's like, you know, like a very valuable thing. It's like a big problem. There aren't really many that are doing it the exact way that we are, which, you know, the real differentiating factor for us is that we make sure we get all of your information. And it means we have to do this like really messy thing that involves getting records in the fax or the mail, and then putting it into an interface that's actually, well, we think, pleasant to work with, as pleasant as, you know, medical interfaces can be. So, right. Yeah, there aren't really people that are doing exactly what we're doing.
The thing that strikes me about growing up in Orange County, and maybe all three of you can comment on this at some point, but I didn't grow up here, but it strikes me as a really entrepreneurial county where a lot of startups happen. And I was wondering if that mentality sort of informed your thinking, if, you know, I mean, as opposed to growing up in Iowa or Florida or something, that you're surrounded by all of these really smart, really innovative startup companies all around you. And I was wondering if either that influence, of course, your parents both being doctors is an influence, but if the sort of the Orange County background, if you think, kind of sparked your interest, entrepreneurial interests.
Yeah, I think definitely, you could definitely say that it did. Like, one thing that's just like really important is just seeing examples. Yeah, like as you're saying, seeing examples of people who have, you know, started their own businesses, really like created a lot of value in different ways, and like kind of like set out to get something done and doing it. So, you know, in Orange County, we do get to see, yeah, a lot of people who have like started their own businesses or working for themselves, and have this kind of like entrepreneurial attitude of, you know, getting things done, and, you know, just seeing that it's possible is like a huge factor in believing that like you yourself can do it.
Yeah. Is there any geographical advantage? I mean, I assume there's a geographical advantage to being in San Francisco just because it's a vibrant spot. But are your patients San Francisco based, or now it doesn't really matter, right? I mean, they could be anywhere.
Yeah, we pretty much we help people. Our customers are all over the country.
Very neat. Very cool. Very cool. Do you have any advice before I let you go? Do you have any advice for graduates? Something that you learned along the way, either in college or before or now, where you either, I don't know, see things going, or industries that you think are promising, what you see in the medical industry where other graduates could step in and help out? Any advice for grads?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'll have my advice be tilted towards startups and entrepreneurship, since that's what I guess know a little bit more about. One thing that's like really surprising is how many businesses, like really big startup companies now, like when they initially started, their approaches were incredibly like hacky. They didn't like build systems that could like, you know, work end to end. They were doing a lot of manual sort of work to actually like get things done. Like, let's say you have like a delivery app, instead of like building a whole system for like routing deliveries and making sure stuff happens, first you just like will take an order like on the phone or with the easiest way that you can, and like carry it yourself to prove that like there's a need and that you can service this need. So I think that's kind of been like one of the most surprising things I've found, is that for these like companies, and you like see like their app or their end product, it seems like everything's very seamless, but at first usually it's just a lot of people doing manual work in the background.
Sadly, right?
Well,
so much manual work in the background.
Yeah, I mean, but like to some extent you need to, you know, prove that like what you're building is something that people need. And so, you know, if you tried to build a whole system out before you tried to like actually make it useful for people, you might spend a lot of time building something that's not needed.
Right. Did your co-founder come from MIT?
She went to Stanford, and, you know, actually it's pretty, the way we actually started the company is pretty interesting. It's out of her own need. She has Crohn's disease, and so had this own situation herself of seeing like 5-6 different specialists, and literally having to carry a binder full of medical records between them to keep them all on the same page. So it was like, you know, she had assumed there had to be a better way, and that there was like all of this change in the space, like shifting towards electronic information, that really made sort of a change possible.
Yeah. Wow. That's a heartening story right there. I love that story right there. That's very neat. Troy Astorino, thank you for joining in.
Yeah, thank you, Marie.
Wonderful. That was Troy Astorino. He is a graduate from MIT, but a recent graduate from Sage right here in Orange County, and he is the co-founder and CTO of Picnic Health. Next up, Emma. Emma Ramadam is a literary translator based in Paris, France. She also is from Sage Hill High School. She went to get her BA from Brown University and her master's in cultural translation from the American University of Paris. Her translation of Anne, I'm totally going to mess up her name, so I'm just going to let you say it.
Anne Galletta, if you want to pronounce it with the accent.
Perfect. I do. I love that. The novel is Sphinx. It was published in April 2015 by Deep Vellum, and she just returned from a year in Marrakesh where she was on a Fulbright grant to translate a number of Moroccan authors. Emma, thanks.
Thanks
for
having me.
So I introduced you, but I'm going to let you introduce you and talk a little bit about, I want to get into the international component of today's graduates. I know a lot of people move abroad, so I want to talk a little bit about that. But talk first just about kind of where this interest started, when you knew you wanted to go into French translation. And we were talking before the show about a couple of the pitfalls, financial pitfalls of it. We can get into that too, but just talk about your path in when this became a passion and you know how you decided to pursue it.
Right. So when I was at Sage Hill for high school, I was studying both French and Latin, and in the Latin classes, all you do is translate because you don't speak it. You don't speak a dead language. So we had this amazing Latin teacher at Sage named Mr. Novotny, who maybe Eric knows also. And that sort of got me started on this kick of how incredible it is to translate and how different each person's translation was and how powerful just one word change can be in bringing a text into English. And we would read this translator's versions of the Aeneid and the Iliad, and they were just so much superior to all the others. And I remember thinking, like, why isn't everybody reading this translation? And it's so sad that there are people who are reading, you know, worse translations. And then when I started studying French literature, I started reading bad translations and realizing that there just aren't a lot of people putting the time in to translating literary works from other languages. And, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, every year 3% of all the books that are published in the States are translations. And of that 3%, maybe half of that or even less is literary work. So, you know, novels or poetry. And so there's so much writing happening in the world and so few people willing to bring it into English that I figured, you know, someone's got to do it. And it's really, this is something that resonated with me. And I really, when I was in college, I started taking translation classes, and that it just fulfilled me in a way that reading and writing hadn't. And I just felt a connection immediately with this craft of translation and being able to combine my creative writing with promoting literature from other languages that I really loved. And yeah, so that was just something I knew I wanted to do after I graduated.
Do you do creative writing on your own aside from this?
Yeah, I write poetry here and there.
Very cool. Yeah. And do you translate the other way as well? Or do you just do French French to English?
Yeah, just French to English.
I like how I say French to U.S.
It is a different English.
It is a different English, right? Yeah. So you went to Brown, and yes. I assume you studied French.
Yeah, I studied comparative literature with French. So I was studying French and French literature and kind of needed a way to make it mean something more. So I switched to the translation track of comparative literature. And Brown sort of has this little nest of professors who are also translators and who are really into converting other students to being translators. So I was lucky enough to have some really great classes over there.
That is very neat. I was a philosophy major in college, and I don't know if you got what I got from my parents, which was, what are you doing and how are you going to make money at this? And, you know, so how supportive have your parents been of, you know, sort of an artistic bent as opposed to an engineering bent.
Right. Well, my parents have been very supportive, thankfully, up until this point, and sort of always they let me and encouraged me to study what I was passionate about in school, knowing that if I didn't do that, then it wasn't worth it. I wasn't going to do well in my classes or be very engaged. And so I was lucky enough to have the chance to study what I wanted and then go on to do a master's in translation as well. And, they ordered my book when it was published in April, and, you know, have a little stack of them in our house. And they, you know, they've been very supportive, but it is a problem, because even though for someone who just graduated, I'm doing pretty well. I have, you know, a book published or a translation published, and, you know, I have other things under contract, and I have sort of constant work. It doesn't pay very well because, you know, the translation publishing houses don't make a lot of money, and they're all nonprofits, and they're all kind of running on donations, so they can barely afford to pay the translators. And it's kind of this ugly cycle of there's just not a huge market for translations in the U.S., and so there's not a lot of money to pay people who are willing to translate the books. And so that's why I applied for the Fulbright grant, because it is this amazing year-long grant to pursue an independent research project. And if you're lucky enough to be awarded one, then you're good to go for a year or a little bit more, depending on how long your grant is, to just do what you said you were going to do. So for me, I had 9 months to translate and not have to worry about, you know, where's the money coming from? What's my other job going to be? How am I going to pay my rent this month? And unfortunately, that's just ended. So I'm sort of in this transition period now where I need to figure out how to go forward and how to allow myself the time and space to keep translating, because that's what I love to do, but not starve. So, you know, how do I keep translating but also make a living? And does that mean I need to get another job? Probably. Does it mean I need to give up translating? No. So figuring out how to go forward now.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the grant process, because I think a lot of students in your situation would drool over getting a Fulbright scholarship. And it's nice to take advantage of just funds out there. At this point, you know, the job market is so uncertain and grants are a great opportunity. So maybe you could talk just a little bit about the process of applying, you know, what it looks like, other grants that are out there that maybe people aren't aware of. I don't know.
Yeah. So the Fulbright grant is a U.S. government grant for people to apply to a specific country abroad and form a research project based around that country, or to teach English if that's what they want to do. So there's the English teaching grants and the independent research grants. And if you do an independent research grant, that grant, it can literally be on anything you want, as long as it is, you know, they find it important, and as long as it has something to do with that country you're applying for. And so when I applied to translate a specific Moroccan author who had never been translated before and who is a very important figure in Moroccan culture, but just nobody's ever heard of him anywhere else. Mm. And the Fulbright committee clearly found that that was a valuable project, and it was, you know, clearly something aimed at spreading Moroccan culture abroad and allowing this cross-cultural exchange between Americans and Moroccan people by allowing more U.S. speakers to hear Moroccan stories through my translations, etc. But there were people on my program who were doing things as different as studying independent art spaces or studying women's weaving cooperatives or studying the way that land is divided up between men and women. So it was really diverse, and it was just a lot of people who are passionate about a specific project in that specific country. And there's Fulbright commissions kind of all over the world. Unfortunately, most of the countries in the Middle East, their offices have closed for, you know, world reasons. But there is still a Fulbright program in Jordan. They're still in the UAE. They're still in Morocco. So, you know, and they're in Asia too. They're in South America. They're all over the place, in Europe, obviously. And, you know, So there's lots of opportunities for people who, you know, have this interest in going abroad, or who have an interest in studying other cultures, or even just being in that culture and teaching English, to apply for one of these grants and have a chance to spend a year exploring that country and, you know, promoting exchange is the idea.
Yeah. Right, right. I'll remind our listeners, you're tuned in to Real People of Orange County on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. It's graduation season, and so I have brought in three grads who grew up in Orange County and have now sort of spread out found their wings. I don't know where I got that phrase. And are exploring the arts. They're exploring two of them were engineering grads that have gone on to do either startups or other things. We're going to get into that other thing here in just a minute. So I also want to talk, Emma, the other thing that strikes me about growing up in Orange County, we were talking about it being entrepreneurial, but it also seems, it seems both insulated and multicultural. It seems like a very insulated, safe environment, but it also seems like a place where people value international travel and multiculturalism. So I'm wondering how you found growing up here translating to you wanting to, you know, expand your horizons and move to France.
Yeah, so, I mean, when I was at Sage Hill, met a lot of students who were either the first generation of their family to be born in the States, they had parents who had grandparents or relatives who had come across to the States at some point and settled in Orange County. And for me, it's the same. My parents are both from, my dad's from Lebanon and my mom is from England and sort of settled here. And it's, that seems to be very common, especially at Sage Hill. I think there's a particular population of diversity there. And so there is this multiculturalism, and yet Orange County does really feel like a bubble, as cliche as that is to say, because everybody says it, but it's true. And that was sort of both an impetus and, you know, something that drove me to get out, and something that I think people like about Orange County. And it's not a bubble in the sense of being racial, you know, a racial bubble. It's not. Orange County is very diverse. It's a bubble in other senses of the word, in that, like, a lot of people who come to Orange County maybe don't leave Southern California, but racially it is very diverse. And so being able to see and interact with different cultures was something that, while I was here, sort of pushed me to explore abroad. And when I went to college, it was really important for me to study abroad.
Yeah. We were talking before the show about how surreal it must be to have lived in Marrakesh and then come back to the Orange County Vons, the Orange County Pavilions, Fashion Island.
Exactly. Yeah, very surreal. It's very calm here. You don't have to haggle for your vegetables, which is really nice.
You can try, it just won't work out for you.
Yeah. True.
I think the thing that I love about travel the most is that you go away and then you come back and you see things with totally fresh new eyes. You just kind of hit on one of those. But I was wondering if you have observations about the U.S. or observations about Orange County, Southern California, having experienced life abroad for a chunk of time that makes you see this place differently.
Yeah. One thing that really strikes you when you're in a country like Morocco or sort of any Middle Eastern country is how many languages everybody speaks. And when I'm in Orange County, people are like, oh, you speak French. That's so interesting. But then you go anywhere else in the world, in particular to Middle Eastern countries, everyone speaks five languages. Even if they're not educated, even if they haven't been to college, they all speak five languages. And so that kind of put another fire under me to keep expanding and keep learning new languages and hopefully, you know, continue down that path of translation. But it's true that something that we were talking about earlier with Troy is that, in particular in California, I think there is this ambition that you don't really see in other places. I didn't see it in France. I certainly didn't see it in Morocco. This people here who do realize that they are coming from a position where they are educated and, you know, they have kind of the world at their fingertips. People are taking advantage of that and trying to make the world a better place, you know, like what Troy is doing. And that's something you don't really see anywhere. You see it in maybe other places in the States, but I think it's really special, and you definitely feel a lot of that energy in California of people trying to take what they were born with and do something really important with it, and I love that.
I'm sad I'm not sending my kid to Sage now that I've talked to the three of you. What a great school. I mean, what a, you know. And you guys were there sort of when it started, right?
Yeah, my brother was actually in the first graduating class from Sage. He's 5 years older. So, I don't know. We can do the math on that later. Graduated 2004.
Yeah.
Something
it's a
like
new
that.
School.
Yeah.
I mean, relatively new school. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's changed a lot since I graduated. So I don't really know if I can speak to what Sage is like now. Maybe Eric can a little bit better than me.
I'm still 4 years out. Not sure I have that much more to add. But,
well, before we leave you, Emma, and we're going to jump over to Eric now. Any advice for graduates coming up now?
Yeah, I think also going off of what Troy said, I think this is the time more than ever where we shouldn't have to compromise what we love to do. And I think maybe other generations didn't have the freedom to pursue what they were really passionate about the way that we do. And I think everyone should take advantage of that and never settle for a job or any kind of, you know, professional situation that doesn't make you really happy every day. And there's always, in this day and age, there's always a way to make it work. So I think everybody should try and, you know, cross their fingers, hope for the best. And yeah,
I mean, the international opportunities, just, I mean, it was very weird to go. You could do a study abroad, but to move abroad would have been a very weird thing back. I'm going to keep saying back in my day, but you know, the international opportunities are really fantastic. The internet opportunities are obviously, you know, vast. That goes without saying. So while it's hard to know what to advise people to do, I think it's because the opportunities are so expansive and there's so many different ways to do it that there weren't before. And, you know, you just have to, you guys are sort of blazing a new path through all of this. So,
yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks.
Very cool. You are tuned in to Real People of Orange County on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are talking to college grads, all hailing from Orange County, all now living in various places, doing various things. Eric Hallett, an old friend of mine, grew up in Orange County, where he attended the Pegasus School in Huntington Beach and Sage Hill in Newport Coast, earning his Eagle Scout degree in the process. 4 days ago, he graduated from Stanford. Congratulations.
Thanks.
With a BS in Product Design Mechanical Engineering. During his time there, he was also a member of the Stanford Mendicants, an a cappella group, and Sigma Nu fraternity. His hobbies include playing piano, beach volleyball, camping, and, of course, playing board games. So we're going to get into the board games now. Because that is Eric's topic of discussion. I'll let you talk about how you got into this, but I know as part of your thesis, you've made a board game.
So yeah, it was kind of a combination of two factors, but I guess first I'll start with the Stanford part. So the product design major is actually, I think it dates back 30 years or so at Stanford, and it's developed over time a lot, and only I'd say in the last 4 or 5 years is it really gaining kind of relevance beyond that little Silicon Valley area. But it kind of teaches this really unique blend of mechanical engineering, like the hard sciences and, you know, how things bend under stress. But also kind of this, there's a few psychology classes required, some art studio. So it kind of takes both the hard sciences and the humanities and blends them into this weird smoothie of this intellectual, I don't know why I went to the smoothie metaphor, but
I like that.
Yeah, this concoction of you know, things you can use, whether you take the more hard engineering route or the you know, kind of the softer what do people want route, and blend them together into something that might be interesting to the public. So anyway, it starts with this need finding process where, first of all, before you know, come up with an idea for a project, you have to empathize with people. So actually, I took this class in which the first assignment was literally to just go watch people in a location for 3 hours and take notes until you came to some unexpected realization about people. And so anyway, you take that all the way through this kind of design process where you empathize and then figure out.
Wait, where were you watching them?
Oh, we watched them all over the place. First, I think the first one we did was at an airport. And we, you know, noticed some sort of gender dynamics about who gets out of the car to greet certain people at the airport and who stays in the car and who helps with the bags. For one project, we focused on bartenders and, you know, figured out something about how even the average interaction with a bartender when you get your drink is only, you know, 30 seconds long. You focus on so much more than that in watching your bartender and evaluating how much you're going to tip them. And so the bartender will continue to wipe down the bar even if there's only one person sitting at the bar and they've cleaned over that space a million times just because appearance is so important in gaining tips. So it's that kind of insight that this design process teaches. And so we, my two, I guess, co-creators of this board game, The Campaign, and I decided to focus on postgrads as our target group for our final kind of senior, what's called a capstone project that we worked on for the past 6 months, as it's kind of the equivalent to a senior thesis. And so we focused on these postgraduates because I think that was a world that was becoming very real to us as we, you know, saw ourselves going into our last few months of college and heading into the world of real people. And, you know, so we talked to a lot of them and kind of we knew we were interested in creating a game, but we really wanted to focus on their needs as well. And, you know, it's in postgrad life, it's spending a lot of time around an apartment with your friends. You're trying to both make new friends and, you know, keep those connections strong with old friends. And so we noticed that actually a lot of them play board games, but not all of them were thrilled with these board games. And I guess this is where the Sage Hill part of this comes in, is that my friends and I in high school played a lot of board games. But we frequently, and even more in recent years, found ourselves, you know, picking holes in the board games. Oh, this could be better if this were true. And, you know, you could really tell how good a board game was, I think, by how much phones were out during the game. And so our goal was to create a game that's interesting enough and different enough and fast-paced enough that, and it moves so quickly that you don't have time to pull out your phone. You know, we live in a world where everyone's checking their phone every 3 seconds or the instant they get uncomfortable. And so I think our, you know, kind of primary goal behind creating a board game was just to really make those, you know, hours you spend in the apartment with your friends meaningful.
That's brilliant. Measuring the success of a board game by how often you pull out your phone, I think that's a really great. That's a fantastic measuring.
It's just
stick.
Something we noticed. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, you watch people long enough and you'll notice things like that.
Yeah, right. Okay, so tell us about The Campaign. How does it work?
So the it's called The Campaign, a seriously absurd political board game. And I think the best part of this is that my two co-founders and I had. I mean, you know, we had never created a board game. We'd played a lot of board games, and we have literally no knowledge of politics whatsoever. And I think that's what we decided qualified us to make a political board game. Anyway, the premise is that you want to win enough electoral votes to become president. It's a 4-to-6-player game, divide up into teams of 2 or 3 in the beginning. And I think the most interesting dynamic of this game is, yeah, the premise is to win the most electoral votes, but winning the most only matters if you're on the winning team. So it's both a team and individual game, and you see a lot of backstabbing and deceit throughout, which makes it really entertaining. It only lasts about an hour. I can just walk through the basics of the game, but it's a 64-card deck that you play through, and so each time you might pull a state card, in which case it might be a party state where just like the Republican candidates compete for that state and the Democratic candidates judge them and vote for the winner. And so the Republican candidates might be giving a speech on. So we came up with all this content ourselves. This was actually like my primary job, was to come up with things that people would find kind of funny and interesting. They'd have, for example, 30 seconds to prepare and 30 seconds to deliver a speech on what is the third best country in the world. So I mean, everyone goes to America first because you're running for president. You'd be stupid to say anything else. But you know, we've gotten answers like Thailand, Vatican City, and even Texas, which you know, if you think about it, doesn't make sense at all. Or you might be trying to define a made up concept, such as the Israeli-China conflict. There's no such conflict that I've heard of, but you know, you'd have 30 seconds to think of what those two countries might have to quibble about and stand up and deliver a funny or serious speech. I think the tone of the game is to lampoon politics and make light of everything. So, you know, it's a game where I think we noticed we had something real there when, like, our very first time, even though we've, you know, refined the game many times since then, the first time someone had to give a speech, they stood up even though we didn't tell them to. So the game features a lot of standing up and yelling at each other, which is a lot of fun. And then one further addition is these political action committee cards that you'll draw throughout the 64 cards. And those kind of use loose political vocabulary. So you might play a filibuster card to skip your opponent's turn right when they're, you know, hoping to make a big move. Or you might use a gerrymandering card to change the way a state is played and turn it into like a Republican Party card, into a card that everyone fights over. And so, yeah, you might battle for states by trying to guess sort of a Price is Right scenario of, like, one is how many TSA employees are there in the United States? And, you know, no one should know the answer to that. But, you know, you want to try to guess as close to the actual number as you can without going over, and you might win a state through those means.
What is the actual number?
I believe this, I only know because I wrote these, but I think it's 55,000.
Good.
And one answer we got was 320.
Wow. So more airports than
yeah, needless to say, they didn't win that one. But anyway, so the tone of the game is very lighthearted, and one thing finally we noticed. The game has to be different the whole time. So, you know, you shuffle these cards at the beginning and draw them in a different order. So, you know, the game's very unpredictable and played a different way each time. But also we noticed that, you know, in these games I played with my friends, my Sage Hill friends in high school, if we noticed we were falling way behind, we would get really bored. And that's when phones would start coming out, or, you know, someone would get angry and knock the whole board off the table or something. So what we created was kind of this wild auction at the very end where you save your leftover money and try to figure out how much to bid for the last five states, which include, you know, Texas, California, Florida, Illinois, all the biggest states. And so even if you're in last going into that, you have a chance to win at the end, which makes for a lot of excitement. So, I mean, yeah, that's kind of the basics of gameplay. The tone is very light. My friends and I described it as a kind of combination of Cards Against Humanity, the irreverence of that, the strategy of Settlers of Catan, and the creativity and humor of Cranium. So, yeah, we describe it as, you know, a funny political game with just enough strategy to make it interesting till the end.
How much do you have to know about politics to play? Because
nothing.
I happen to know Barack Obama's president, and then I drop off after that.
That's more than I have. No, I mean, we know next to nothing about politics. And, you know, it's funny because we have, you know, in our fraternity house, all three of us were members of the same fraternity. And we have some political science majors who would get really into the game. And, you know, the thing was, they sometimes would use that knowledge, but you didn't find it necessarily help them. The key is just mm-hmm. all you need to go into the game with is an open mind and some laughter ready and maybe a bottle of beer. But I know next to nothing about politics, and I think my co-founders would agree with that statement that you just have to be creative and quick on your feet.
It's funny what makes board games successful. I happen to know the I don't know, descendants of the creator of Connect Four. They're wildly wealthy.
I bet.
Especially once it made it onto the internet. Like, now it's an app for your iPhone, and they're all like, cha-ching, I made so much money right now.
Yeah, they're,
but it
they're
is
doing
funny.
Right.
They're doing all right. But, you know, whatever the psychology is that goes into making board games successful, some of them totally take off. And, you know, I'm sure there are a lot that I haven't heard of that haven't. But you're up on Kickstarter,
yes.
See, that's how little I know that I don't even know it's Kickstarter, but Kickstart. So tell me a little bit about that, about the process of launching the board game and what you need to do it.
So yeah, in this 6-month project, it's only a requirement that you make a product and, you know, talk to manufacturers as though you were to manufacture it. So, you know, there are some people who at the end of this class decided, you know, let's just take some pictures of this pretty thing I made and put it in a portfolio and never think about it again. But I mean, we spent so many hours on this and seen it grow from this. Literally at one point, I just free-handed a map of the United States, and we had these pins and these like green construction paper that we used as money. And it's developed into something that's beautifully graphic designed by this guy, Erica Washita, who's one of our co-founders. And it really is a piece of art at this point. You know, there are pictures on the website. But anyway, so it's gone from, we've seen it from its very inception and watched it get slightly better, get really bad, and then we think get awesome. And, you know, we've watched people, you know, play the game, ask to play it again, have a blast while they play the game. And so we're really passionate about it, and we decided we really wanted to try to make a go of it on Kickstarter. But the problem is, I was telling my mom this today, but the idea is, I mean, ideally we'd only make 200 to 300 copies because, you know, that's how many friends and family we'd have to get it started. But when we suggested that to a manufacturer, they literally laughed at us because apparently it's only worth it to them to make 1,500 copies or so of the game because of the tooling associated and aligning the printers the right way and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So as it turns out, you know, 1,500 copies is the absolute minimum we could make. And so we're trying to raise $25,000 on Kickstarter to cover all of that plus shipping. So even if we did meet our $25,000 goal, we would be making absolutely no money from this and probably losing money, but it's a price we're willing to pay to try to get this out into the real world. So right now, we started off hot with, I think we made, you know, $7,000 or so in the first week and things were looking good, but then we hit graduation week and just didn't have time to focus on it. And so things have kind of stalled. But anyway, you know, I think we're close to 9,000 now and, building some more momentum. So anyway, this is a shameless plug that if you're at all interested in what I've been describing for the past 15 minutes, some, I don't know if it's family fun, but it's certainly adult fun. And, maybe someday we could come out with an edition that would be, more family fun. But, anyhow, it's, the website is kickstarter.com, and if you search The Campaign, you'll find it, or you can search www.tinyurl.com/thecampaignboardgame. And it is cool. If we get funded and you contribute a certain amount, you'll get a copy of the board game, our first edition. And it's something we've poured our heart and souls to, and for the past 6 months we're pretty thrilled with what we've created, and we're just hoping for the best now so that we can bring this to people and, you know, put the game on shelves someday.
And you have a Facebook page.
We do have a Facebook page. Yeah. Sorry?
Don't forget that.
Yes, we also have a Facebook page. Actually, Sigma Nu National wrote an article about us when we, you know, sent in our info. And so we've gotten a bit of publicity. Thanks to Marie here for having me in today to shamelessly plug the game. but yeah.
It's very cool. You so once you get the $25,000 goal and you manufacture, how many did you say?
1,500.
So you have these in your garage. Then what do you do? I'm just curious about the whole process.
So yeah, I mean that's kind of the next step is if we're lucky enough to make it. So we'd ship copies to people that contributed certain amounts. There are certain ladders. Like if you contribute, I think 40 or 50, you get a copy of the game and a T-shirt and that sort of thing. And if you contribute 100, you get a couple copies. If you contribute 500, you'll get, you know, more copies than you asked for probably. And so anyway, there is a good chance we end up with a lot of these at the end. But at that point, we'd probably take them to game stores or toy stores and try to sell them to them or even just give them to them and hope they give us some commission off what they sell. So that's the end game if we do successfully get funded.
That is very cool. I love it. I've never heard of a developer of a board game. That's brilliant. I mean, besides my Connect 4 friend.
Of course.
Who's doing well. And last minute advice for grads. I love the concept of the product design. I mean, I think... I haven't heard of that as a major. Is that a Stanford unique major? And what have other friends gone on to do with that? It sounds like a great major.
It is a Stanford unique major as of now, although I think other universities are kind of catching on and realizing its significance. So let's see, where was I? Oh, so anyway, yeah, people go into a number of different fields with that. There's now a job at Facebook called product manager, and a lot of different companies have that. You'll rarely find a job description that says product designer. I think if you did, we'd all be employed at this moment. but so, you know, people can really go anywhere with that. Some are working at General Motors in Detroit, and, you know, people just kind of scatter. It's just a really valuable skill, I think, to be able to empathize with people, figure out what their needs are, find solutions for them, and refine those solutions so that they're really valuable and they're actually what people want instead of, you know, what producers want to give to people.
Yeah.
So I guess my final advice would be, I remember at my graduation in 2011 from Sage, someone had come in with telling us about this product, about the chance to create a gourmet ketchup. And,
that's my brother.
Is that actually your brother?
Oh,
wow.
Oh, my God.
Well, okay. We're just selling the connections everywhere. But anyway, I thought that was fascinating as a high school graduate that someone could, you know, graduate well from Sage and, you know, go on to create a ketchup company. And so I guess my final advice would be, you know, it's definitely great to have a real job coming out of college, but absolutely take the chance. I think kind of what Emma was saying, to create something of your own. You know, you never know what you'll be doing to earn your actual salary, but it's definitely cool that regardless of what happens with this Kickstarter campaign, this will be a board game I've created from scratch with friends, and I'll be able to play it. And hopefully if you fund us, you will be able to, too.
You will too. So, say the website one more time.
It's kickstarter.com, and search for The Campaign, or www.tinyurl.com/thecampaignboardgame.
So great. So all of you, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming on. This was really fun.
It was so much fun.
Yeah, it is fun. It is fun. I love getting to talk to the best part of this radio station. So many great parts, but one of the best is that I just get to call anybody I want and they come in and talk to me. So that's fun.
That's great. Call me anytime.
Yeah, anytime. That's all the time we have for today. I will be right back here with you next Thursday evening again. Ben Peters, who has lived in Orange County, I think he's in his... I don't know. He's in his 70s. He knows everything about Orange County. He was there when Disneyland opened. He has the best Orange County stories. So our resident historian is going to come in and give us a little bit of history of Orange County. If you missed any part of today's show, it will be podcast shortly on KUCI's website, kuci.org/talk. It will be on Kimberly's website, kimberlymartin.com. I think it might be on iTunes. I think she podcasts on iTunes. But anyway, you can find a copy of this podcast all over the place. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Counterspin. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Stay tuned.